Hi, this is Barry Walsh of Killahore Orchards, makers of cider Johnny Fall Down, based in Killahore, Clontown, County Cork, Ireland. And you are listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 157. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincoller, and I am the producer and a cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This week, it is a conversation with Barry Walsh of Killahore Orchards in County Cork, Ireland. It's actually the first chat I'm having with an Irish cider maker on this here podcast, and I'm really happy to bring it to you because not only are we going to hear a little bit of conversation, we're going to hear a wee bit of Irish singing too. So what's not to love about that? In the meanwhile, before we get to that main feature, we're going to have a little bit of news out and about in Ciderville. As a cider maker, I know how much work it takes to take that apple from the orchard, never mind the apple, just starting the roots of the tree, then to the apple, out to the press room, into the bottle, and then eventually into the glass to make it taste wonderful. Well, you know, I know that, and I also know a little bit about podcasting, and they're kind of similar. There is a bit of finesse and loving care that goes into every, what I like to call, release. I'm starting to call them vintage releases here. Now that we are on episode 157 and it comes out weekly, which I have to admit, I know is a little bit easier to do as a podcast than as a cider. You can't have a vintage release every week. I don't think so. I guess you could do a bit of blending and do it, but you know, you got to worry about labeling and all that jazz. Anywho, because of that, and all the work, I do need support for getting this podcast out there. And I have a website that I link to called Patreon. And via that, people can become patrons of this here podcast. And this week, we had Jonathan sign up. So welcome to Patreon for Cider Chat. Jonathan, thank you very much. This day that this podcast here goes live, the patrons are going to get an extra bonus piece that I selected off from my main chat with Barry Walsh of Killahore Orchards. It's going to be on Perry's. You know, I have a certain affection for Perry's, as I am sure many people do in Ciderville. And that will be posted later on in the day. If you're interested in becoming a patron, you could just go to the links on the ciderchat.com site and find that info there. Another way to help support this podcast is via PayPal. And in fact, we had someone new sign up to that link, and that is none other than Eleanor Leger of Eden Ciders, Eden Specialty Ciders. She is well known in the U.S. for her ice ciders, sharing her knowledge, just an extraordinary woman. She was also on this here podcast speaking about cidernomics. So I will put a link in the show notes to that, but do check out Eden Ciders because right now, if you put in a certain code, you got to go to the website to find out, you could get free delivery on 3 bottles of cider. Score, so your shopping for the holidays just got a whole lot easier. Again, thank you, Eleanor. You are absolutely sweet, sweet, sweet. She wrote that she felt, you know, a little shy about doing this. She was wondering, why didn't I do this much sooner? And she wrote, you, talking about me, I'm a pioneer in cider podcasting, and what you do has helped bring so many great cider stories to light that otherwise wouldn't have. Thank you so much, Eleanor. Thank you for the support, and thank you for making cider keep on going up around the world. If you don't know about that cidery up in Newport, Vermont, and their new tasting room and charcuterie board and cheese scene that's happening right in the hub of the Burlington, Vermont area, you have to find out. It is a destination. There's been a little bit of a conversation about CiderCon, which is taking place the week of February 4th. It really kicks off on the 5th of February, right smack in the middle of Chicago Cider Week. And some of the conversation is like, well, should I go? Should I go? Oh, can I afford it? You know, now is the time to start making plans. If you're going and you could handle sharing a room with somebody, dang, you know, that's like $60 a night. That does make it doable, I'm hoping. And think about it. You're not going to be spending a lot of time in that room anyways, because you're going to be out and about moving through Chicago, moving through that giant megalith hotel. Don't worry, I've been there before. So if you see me, I think I'll be able to point you in the right direction, maybe down to the little cider hole, kind of like a rabbit hole. I should probably carry a little extra bottle in my bag for people if I meet them and they're lost in the hotel. And you get parched. Oh my, I love having fun at these events. And CiderCon is like that. It's a place that you might be thinking, oh, I don't know anybody, I'm going to feel overwhelmed. Is it worth it? Well, first off, the networking is absolutely worth it. Secondly, on top of that networking, you have all the workshops, this really well curated schedule, the team that's been doing it, they've got it down now. It's pretty seamless in that way. The workshops are absolutely worth it. If you are a commercial maker, the TTB folks are there. And from what I understand, they're always happy to have a conversation. I'm hoping to actually have a conversation with them too. Fingers crossed. But there's just so much to take in. So don't hesitate. Start planning now. And when should you land? Well, don't wait until Wednesday when things kick off. And this is my professional tips as someone who travels and has done a lot of traveling for work. It's very wise to land the day before, to kind of get your city legs in, get into the jazz of Chicago. Don't just focus on CiderCon 2. Get the flavor of the area, because that is a tremendous market if you're a commercial maker. I mean, who wouldn't want to have that market? My goodness, all those people just thirsty for your cider, and you get to kind of test it there. But part of testing is not whether or not they like tasting your cider, but getting to know them too. So I always say, arrive early, be in the city, screw taking like a little, you know, shuttle. Take the train to the hotel. You have a little bit of walking to do. Sheesh, if I could do it with two bags in tow, I know that you can too. In the meanwhile, also make sure that you get on the registration now for CiderCon 2019. You could just put that in your browser, where it's CiderCon 2019. Up will come the website, ciderassociation.org. You'll find the hotel reservation link there and the reservation or registration for CiderCon itself. It's so worthwhile, and I hope to see you there. Regular listeners of Cider Chat know the name Adam Levy, because last year I was helping to promote the New York beer competition that just took place. I think it was in the end of January or beginning of February of 2018. And I kept on saying, hey, you know, if you put in enough entries of cider, they will, or Adam will, have a dedicated cider competition. Well, guess what, Ciderville? It has happened, and it's going to be taking place on February 10th. What's unique about this competition is that the judges are not your classic, you know, cider makers themselves. All the judges are trade buyers judging by category and price, and they're using the United States Association of Cider Maker categories. And for this competition, I'm going to be reminding you on this for a number of episodes coming up, they are offering free shipping from their warehouse in New Jersey and a warehouse in Canada to ship free to the Berlin International Competition too. So I'm going to have some links there. So there's a number of competitions. The one that happens in New York on February 10th, and then later in 2019, there's going to be one in Berlin. So let's say you have one cider. You could send six bottles. They'll save three of those bottles for the New York competition, and then ship for free those three additional ciders to the Berlin competition. So you get a lot of, well, cider time there. And I suspect some really good feedback. So that's what I want to just highlight this week. Next week, I'm going to let you know how you could put in your submission and get a discount for registering that. But in the meanwhile, I want you to go to the link for the New York Cider Competition that is in the show notes here, and start planning now. This is a great opportunity to have a very different core complement of judges. So stay tuned for that. And when I come back, we're going to come on with our main feature chat with Barry Walsh of Killahora Orchards in County Cork, Ireland. It's time to start getting those glasses filled and head to Ireland in the region of County Cork. We're going to be speaking with Barry Walsh of Killahora Orchards. It is he and his cousin Dave Watson who are behind this whole operation and a couple other family members too. But Barry will fill you in on that. What I really enjoyed listening to this conversation with Barry for is, well, one is his accent. Ugh. You just got to love that. He's really articulate, and he has that kind of metaphorical storytelling way that is just delightful to hear. One of my favorite quotes was, "If you make something that is unique and to some extent punches you in the face with apples, then that's enough." Spoken like a true Irishman. So make sure that glass is filled, and you'll probably want to be filling it again and again because I suspect you're going to be getting thirsty. We're going to go straight into Barry telling us a bit about the region where he lives and the orchard upon which these award-winning ciders are made.
Just at the southern tip, so Cork would be the second city of Ireland, although people in Cork will it's known locally as the real capital, but it's kind of, it has a, as that second city feel to it, and that it's a bit quirkier and people are a little bit more independently minded. It's also known as the rebel county. Being at the southern tip, we do get the advantage of slightly warmer and slightly more sun, but we also have a lot more climate to contend with. But as you and probably a lot of your listeners know, sun and cloud and rain is not a bad thing for trees. So it's a good combination for us. Cork has a long agricultural heritage, given the valleys and the rain and the weather. So we would like some of the meat produce and some of the dairy produce is some of the best in the world. And it's taken us years, and in typical Irish fashion, it's taken other countries to tell us it's good before we really appreciate what we have ourselves. It was the centre of the butter world for 100 years, I think, until the Danes invented the centrifuge. So Cork has a fabulous and thriving pub scene. It's a very popular kind of weekend destination. It's quite a dense town in terms of your ability to get around, so it's great for pub crawls. We have some fabulous restaurants, some of the best restaurants in the country. We've recently got 3 Michelin stars in Cork City. Well, in fact, one is farther south out in West Cork. We have an amazing Japanese restaurant, a Miyazaki restaurant, Chestnut, down in West Cork. They sell some of our products, and So it's really come on in leaps and bounds in the last 10 years by taking some of the best produce and making something more creative or more, you know, adding more value to it. And it's created an amazing scene of food bloggers and people who are just genuinely interested. So it's a great time to be part of to be a premium producer in a time where premium is now being valued more than just value, you know, or more than just the cost, or in terms of alcohol, more than just ABV.
Right. So let's go and talk about your premium product here. I have these two beautiful bottles sitting in front of me. To admit, I do have some of the rare apple ice wine poured in a glass already, because it's never too early. I think it's a really amazing story that you have there in the orchard. So let's let listeners know a little bit about the past, what you've been discovering while you've been doing this, and if we could, let's start there.
Killahora Orchards, which is essentially we started as Johnny Fall Down because it was just an idea, and then we've kind of evolved into something else. But Killahora Orchards is essentially myself and my cousin Dave, who bought the land, Dave's wife Kate, who does some marketing and branding and reaching out and sales, and Dave's dad Tim Watson also, who tends the orchard. And pretty much anyone who's unfortunate enough to come across our way around autumn time and thinks that pressing apples is a nice romantic notion, they find out fairly quickly that it's romantic for the first half hour maybe, but four or five hours into it, it changes. But so it started when Dave bought the land. He got some acreage up around just outside Cork, quite close to where he's from. We're both from Cork. And at the time, I was making some booze, if you pardon the term. It's pretty much the term I use. So, you know, we're not, I'm sure the censors aren't going to edit it too heavily. And I was making, you know, elderflower champagne, and I was making some beer, and I was dabbling with this, that, and the other. And I'm originally a process engineer myself, so I'm, you know, quite comfortable with fermentation. And Dave is also a scientist. He did a doctorate in science. So he bought the land and was looking to do something with it, and said, you know what, I'm thinking of planting apples. And I thought, well, look, you know, seems like a reasonable idea. Why don't we just give it a go? And Dave has a great interest in botany, and has collected seeds from all over the world, and has this amazing Walimi pine, which is a prehistoric tree that he'd collected in Australia. So I mean, the land now has got eucalyptus and oaks and Pacific redwoods and all these amazing, amazing things. So Dave put together essentially a palette of at this stage, over 100 apple varieties and 30 peri-pear varieties, which at the start I wouldn't necessarily have had much knowledge of, or, if I'm being frank, much interested in. I was more a case of, right, what can we make from these? Now, subsequently, as the years have gone on and I've seen the wild variations between, say, an early sweet and a late bitter sharp, you know, I mean, they're farther apart than a white grape is from a red, as you know, people in Ciderville will know. So it's really been a journey then of discovery. And our goal was never to create a business that could fit into a market gap. It was, let's do as the best we can at every step and see what happens. And if a business comes out of it, great. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So, I mean, Dave went to the nth degree to get amazing trees. And we've got trees from, you know, we've got Bacran red apples. We've got stuff from, you know, recently just got some pears from Swabia and some rare Austrian musts and all sorts. So we've really gone to the nth degree in that. And we've kind of just taken it slowly rather than trying to grow quicker than our apples are growing. We've grown in parallel with the apples. So we're really trying to match our growth with the onset of more and more fruit. And we're getting a new variety of fruit every year because we've planted the apples in stages. So I think by the end of this season, this planting season, we'll be up around 1,000 trees, of which, I mean, we can go through them in a little, but I mean, we call it, say, rare apple ice wine or rare apple cider because we have just such a range of apples that other people haven't planted, really. And I mean, that's not to say that they're all necessarily worth planting. I mean, there's some trees that, you know, because they might be biennial, or they might be prone to canker, or they mightn't, you know, they don't orchard that well. So there's a reason why, you know, people don't grow every apple. But then when you taste like, say a Prince William or a Medai d'Or or an Oldfield pear, you kind of go, right, it's a pain in the ass, but this is worth planting. Mm. So we've kind of evolved that. And the land itself is quite unique as well, because it's south facing. It's on the coast. We're literally overlooking Cork Harbour. I think I'd sent a few pictures. So we get a nice, it's nice and breezy, but we're also sheltered from southwesterlies, which would be the predominant prevailing wind. It drains very well, which is amazing for our peri pears, because they don't like getting their feet wet. So we tend to have a slightly longer season. We get higher SGs. And the other fundamental thing, which again, we didn't know at the start, is that the land was largely sitting there for 20 or 30 years. So it hadn't really been fertilized, was just sitting there. And that lack of fertilization fundamentally changes the fermentation speed and it gives you just that little extra something, none of which we really knew when we started. And it kind of brings me to a point we were just discussing last week, how, I won't call it ignorance, but the manual nature of the cider we were making just gave quality. It's not something we've appreciated until now, that we're starting to get more apples and we're having to look at mechanization and so on. Like, when you hand pick something, you can leave it there, sweat for 3 or 4 weeks. But you can't do that with machine harvested apples, because, you know, they're battered to, the life is battered out of them. Similarly, we macerated because when we started, like, we were using just a manual press, and we've only recently upgraded to a Varan hydraulic. But because we didn't have the time to do scratting and pressing on the same day, we'd scrat the night before. So we ended up macerating by default rather than by design. And similarly then, because, you know, again, it was just a sideline, leaving the cider do its thing was the default way of doing it, rather than being tending it and worrying about it and, oh no, it's not doing this or it's not doing that. And all these things tend to actually bring out quality rather than the opposite.
You mentioned that you're hand picking, and I also imagine that you could pick up drops on the ground too. Is that true for Irish cider?
Actually, it would be almost the opposite. We almost solely pick windfalls. It's only really a last ditch little bit towards the end of the season that would shake them out. I mean, we kind of go on the rule of thumb. When we started, Dave planted some of it on M111s and some on M106, the rootstocks. So we were kind of learning about how to plant and how to the densities and so on. Now, everything that we planted probably after our second year was kind of on the dwarfing rootstocks, I think is the MM106. No, I could be wrong. I'm the booze geek, Dave is the tree geek. Because of that, we were kind of just leaving apples fall, and we didn't necessarily have the time to be picking them. And Tim, who tends the orchard, kind of didn't want to be shaking them. So what we were doing is just leaving them fall. And once half of them had fell, then we were taking the rest. You give it a bump, and if it looked like they wanted to fall, that was good enough. Windfalls, you know, I've kind of read before that in the US it's kind of there's a concern about windfalls, but we've never had the problem. So we tend to wash apples again manually, unless we're hand picking the late parts, because, you know, they've generally been rained on, so we can kind of get away without that step sometimes. But we mostly just pick them up off the ground, stick them into plastic bins, and bring them down in a small little lawnmower type yoke and give them an old spray.
Since Dave was the tree geek, did he plant the orchard in a way that was conducive to, like, the fruiting season? Certain bitter sweets here, bitter sharps there, or, you know.
He had an original strategy based around varietals and based around the characteristics. So, we put like what we'd call the ladies, so, like, you know, Fiona, Jilly, Lizzie, all the recent kind of the Long Ashton type apples, they were kind of grouped into one section, and pears were grouped into a section. And we kind of learned from that, that that isn't really the best way to do it, because you have to kind of pick one here and then you're walking 10 trees down and you're kind of picking up that one, and it's a bit haphazard. So subsequently, but look, I mean, it was kind of what we've affectionately called it as taking an alcoholic pencil for a walk a little bit at the start. But in later plantings, because we live three fields, or essentially three orchards on the land, we'll be planting them according to harvesting time. So we'll do a row of earlies, a row of mids, a row of lates, and a row of peripairs. And that's kind of what we'll probably do going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did send some photos, and I will post those photos in the show notes for this episode. It's a beautiful location, like you said, above on the south side. I could see water in the distance. And the trees themselves, now you have a range of trees there. You have kind of like wilding trees, right, like fence line apple trees.
After Dave bought the land, and he had the notion of planting the apple trees, and to be fair, just like Tim did probably most of the planting, Dave was in there. I've got involved in some of the planting, but I'll credit you to Tim there. But and like the land, it was just so just wild, and it was just bits everywhere and bits of old farm machinery. So it seemed like an impossible task to have to clear it. And just to see what it is now compared to what it was is just amazing. I decided to look into the old, what we call OS maps, Ordnance Survey maps, and I did a survey in 1838. And we found that, it might have been Dave found it, I can't remember, but lo and behold, wasn't there an orchard there in 1838? And I looked back at an earlier record, and there was a tithe payment for that orchard about 15 years prior. And they subsequently found an older document, which was from the late 18th century, talking about cider production in the townland of Carlagh, I think, which is just down the road. So we have a discussion in an 18th century document, which was kind of the high point of Irish cider making, which is brief, but it was maybe 100 or 200 years, similar to the UK. And there, lo and behold, was an orchard 200 years ago, almost. So it was just such an amazing coincidence. And no, to be fair, when he saw the land, when it started to clear out, an old orchard wall, which was kind of vaguely visible, became more visible. And subsequent to that, and it was probably, I'd say it was probably even the second year that we had planted, or after we had planted, we said, do you know, there's got to be some old wildings or some crab apple trees in the hedgerows. So we skirted around the perimeters of the land, and I'd say there must be 15 or 20 wild apple trees. And there's kind of three wild apple trees that you'd find in Ireland, and there still is a little bit of the Malus sylvestris, which is the actual true wild apple, which actually has thorns on it. They're rare, but they can be found. And then there's the other two, which would be the crabs, which are the small, gnarly, angry little fellas. And what we have, which is predominantly what we'd call wildings, which are clearly derived from cider apples. So one of them looks like a kind of a Bulmer's Norman type. It's kind of yellow with these little bright pink little spots on it. And there's another one with this lovely red and green. And both of them are a fairly hefty size, so they're clearly not crabs. It was just such an amazing kind of bit of icing on top that we found this old heritage in the land, and we found these old apples, which I would say, I mean, one of the trees is easily over 150 years old. It's absolutely massive. So we'd like to think, and I'd say there's fairly sound basis that these have descended from the earlier orchard, which there was very little trace of it when we got onto the land. The first planting was done in probably early 2011. And we planted in 2012 and 2014, and probably it was 2016 as well. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably do more planting this year. So we've kind of been doing it according to, you know, notions and where we had perceived gaps. So we kind of missed a few bitter sharps, and then we had a lot of late bittersweet. So we planted some of the earlier bittersweets, like the Fionas and Lizzies and stuff, if I'm remembering them right. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of getting interesting now, because apples that we didn't have last year, we do have this year. So we got our first red-fleshed apples this year, very few, but it's great to see them coming out. We got some Perry pears this year that we didn't have last year, because those things take a long time. It was 8 years, you know, really, before we kind of sat getting anything out of them. And we lost one of our favorite trees last year in a storm. Mm. So really, from when we started, when the first apples were planted, that's when I kind of started saying, right, I need to learn how to make this stuff. Because, I mean, at the time, I hadn't really drank cider at all. I was more into beer. And I suppose the reason for that is largely, and we might touch on it later, is the fact that the cider market in Ireland was pretty much kind of unidirectional, in that it was all just Bulmers. If they weren't making it, you weren't drinking it. And it was grand, and there were some cheaper ciders, but it wasn't particularly inspiring. And I hadn't tasted French cider, and I hadn't tasted West Country cider. So to me, cider was just one thing. And this is one of the legacy issues that we kind of have in Ireland a little bit, and to the UK, similar problems. So at that stage, I started kind of pressing some apples that were in, local trees. And my wife and my girlfriend at the time, they had 5 or 6 old apple trees, and pressed some of those. And I was really learning the process for the first few years, and learning how to press apples, how to scrad them, how the fermentation process works, what it did when it went bad, and, you know, just simple basic things. And it was a couple of years of that. And then we started to get apples probably maybe the third year. And I had got some bittersweets from someone else who had an old orchard. I wouldn't have known they were bittersweets at the time, but I kind of would be able to recognize it now fairly quickly. So really, from about 2014, 2015, then we started to kind of say, this actually mightn't be too bad, but hadn't really rated it in terms of comparing it to other ciders on the market. And around that time, more Irish craft ciders were coming out. I mean, like, we had the likes of Mark Jenkinson from Cockagee, who makes a fabulous Keeve cider, and you have Longways. James has a bittersweet orchard up in Kilkenny and Tipperary. And some of these were coming out, and I was kind of starting to notice the length of finish, and notice some nuances that I hadn't noticed before, and that was kind of starting to get more interesting. And it was around that time that our bittersweets were coming out, and I was saying, this is something interesting here. So really, it was 2015-2016 was our first commercial release, even though we had done a couple of batches before, kind of, you know, a couple of 100 liters, and kind of giving them away, and but really, we were from 2015-2016 was when we got our license, and that's when we started producing.
These ciders are spot on and unique too. So let's talk a little bit about them. I know you have 3 products, and you're going to be coming out with some more, but let's talk about the 2. Perhaps we should go to the wild.
Yeah, well, a Boucher.
Yeah.
That'd be the cork. I'm waiting.
Yep.
Have an old sip of one there, and where we're at, since we're going down that road.
There we go.
First product was a rare apple bittersweet cider, which would have been a more what I'd consider a commercial cider, but would be a lot more complex than any commercial cider really in Ireland. And that was something that we were making with there's a chap who's kind of central to the craft apple industry here. Contrast has got the apple farm up in Tipperary, so he does some contract bottling for us. So we were maturing it and just leaving it sit there for a year and acquiring all these strange characteristics. Like, our first cider house had a plastic roof, so the temperature fluctuations were massive, and that created this amazing diacetyl note. Now, it was borderline fault, but on the right side of that border. So and saying fault is the wrong word. I mean, you know, someone can be very tall, and you wouldn't consider being tall a fault. It's just you're tall. So with this, the first cider we made, it had this lovely butterscotch kind of lengthy finish, and it was very. I don't know. We won a lot of awards, golds, and lost in a heron, and great taste, and all this. But it was only then when
Wait a minute. That you're just kind of like jumping over all these awards. But that's not something that just, you know, we won this award. I would say, wow, you won some amazing awards there. And that's not something to just pass by. So let's back up a little bit and make mention of some of the awards that you recently just received in 2018 for this particular cider.
Yeah, that particular cider. What had happened there with that one, that was the international supreme champion in the Royal Bath and West.
Yeah.
Which it is, without a doubt, you know, our most favorite award. It is as a cider maker. I mean, it's great to win other awards, which we have, but that one is really a benchmark, you know. And we also sent a Poiret, which it got a bronze in the international championship, but it was the only international Perry that won a medal, so I'm considering that a gold. And then I got a call in the morning, and he said, "You've won the Supreme International Champion," and I was fairly gobsmacked at that one. We had made our first cider, and that was something that we were back sweetening with juice and then carbonating. We were slightly over carbonating it because I wanted to give it a bit more more vibrance. But subsequent to that, I tasted some bottle fermented ciders, and I was kind of going, "Look, this is really the direction that, you know, from in terms of quality, that's what I'd like to do." So started experimenting with different styles. So the Boucher was kind of a nod to, say, the French style. I mean, this isn't a keeved cider as such, but, and this in fact is actually a method traditionnel or a method champenois cider. But I had made a kind of half the batch in the Boucher style, where it was bottling before it was finished, and the other half with back sweetening. Now this particular cider, the Wild Apple Boucher, I mean, the titratable acidity in it is fairly nuts. I mean, it's up around 8. Being that we can kind of add a little dosage, it's not as voraciously acidic as it could be. But the other thing is that because we solely use wild fermentations, malolactic just kind of, it takes the, you know, it knocks the acidity well down. So that's kind of taken care of it to some extent.
A wonderful cider. You know, I actually opened it last night because I knew that I was going to be drinking a little bit early in the day than most days for me. And it has it has really developed. I think folks, really listeners, should know that sometimes you open a bottle and you want to first get that initial smell and kind of then discover it as the apple's been contained in there for all that time and let it mature in the glass. And as it matures in the glass, it's just more and more depth coming out. It's just a very tiny bubbles, and that's that technique that Barry's talking about that lends itself, because it's not forced carbonated. It's a bottle-conditioned cider in that way. And I would say it's kind of like a deep yellow straw color to it. When I initially opened it, I just felt like I was just walking in the pasture of the orchard there. And then since then, it's just developed even further. Now, we're saying like 12 hours later, and the nose is much more, I can perceive more of the wild yeast there, but very specific. It's a very unique cider. The beauty of doing this kind of style of cider making, where you're using the wild yeast of your own terrain, your own terroir, is we are taken right into County Cork, right into Killahara Orchard on the hillside facing to the south sun there, the south slope. It's delicious, a really fine made cider. And wow, you know, think about it. You're kind of new to this game.
Yeah, no, that's fabulous. I really appreciate that. Descriptors you have there would probably exceed my own ability to properly describe it. But one of the things, and just to pick up one of the things there, you said French ciders. I mean, I love French ciders, but I have tasted some keeved ciders, and they're so conscious of the potential of framboise and false because of the high sugar that you don't tend to get some of the nuances that you can get when you ferment to dryness and leave it age and have malolactic. And you can, there's a little bit of breath in this. So I personally like farm. I love the farm vibe from that you get from the interaction of malolactic and tannins. And there's just enough in this that you get a hint of it. And there's a little bit of length. Well, there's a lot of length from the malolactic. So there's a bit of creaminess in it.
Yeah.
And I sometimes find that some of the keeved ciders, while they're fabulous and they love that properly keeved flavor you get up front and the deep richness of it, it tends to be to have less opportunity to go its own way. And this cider has done it. I mean, one of the cornerstones of what we do, other than quality, is an attempt at innovation, and that's that's partially due to just, you know, us wanting to achieve more and being competitive with ourselves. Cellaring has become something that has been a bit of a joy this year, because the ciders that I made 2 years ago, which I had kind of put aside and went, I won't call it a failed experiment, but it's not what I wanted it to be, has suddenly turned up to be amazing 2 years later. Like, we did a really heavy bittersweet Boucher, which was just a little bit much. There's a load of farm in it, a bit dry, but give it a year and it's suddenly something that's a lot more interesting. So that's kind of a by the way learning that we've kind of done.
You sent me a photo of a large barn. So is that what you're talking about, that being the cider house?
But the cider house was an old, I'd say it's probably about, it's easily 150 years old, an old brick, like, farmhouse. Because the farm has been there since the late 18th century. So it's evolved into two or three buildings, and it had one of the first three-story buildings in the area, which was used as a landmark for navigators, and that burned down, I think, in the 19th century. But the cider house is the picture where you're looking up. There's kind of a what looks like a newly plastered building, but it's kind of just render stuck on the old building.
Okay.
So it's kind of two stories. It's maybe, I don't know, 30 square meters on top, and the same. We have our cellar down below, which is this really, you know, this three, 4 foot thick walls. It's damp, it's dank, it's got great thermal mass. I don't think it ever gets above 16 degrees and then 99% humidity. So we've got barrels down there and stuff. So we've had an opportunity to kind of use what's there as much as possible. In some cases, it's a positive, in some cases, not so much, but it is what it is, you know, and that's what makes it unique.
Right. So you do have barrels, and is that how you're making your rare apple ice wine? And I want to ask you about the name there, because are you calling it a rare apple ice wine because you're using a different kind of apple versus the classic ice cider apple, which would be used like with more culinary?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. There's a couple of reasons, and we kind of debated the name wine. The EU have certain regulations, which were, you know, in reality we're probably not compliant with. But as we had a review there in by Tanya in Jancis Robinson. I don't know if you're familiar with Jancis Robinson. She's quite an influential wine writer. But we had an amazing review of it there. And she said, look, it's not compliant in terms of EU, but the Irish don't give a feck. And that's kind of a little bit of it. But we're compliant in terms of our local duty regulations, in that it is technically classed as a wine. We specifically chose the word wine because of the connotations of cider that still exist and are prevalent in both the UK and Ireland, which is our initial markets. I think we'll probably export farther once we get up to the volume. And that's why we chose it. And rare apple, I mean, our ciders, like we would call our first cider a rare apple cider, because, and you know, we might touch on it later, some of the cider varieties are rare. And we've specifically got these apples just to try and show the depth and breadth of what apples can produce. And that rare is both a kind of a separation in terms of what we're doing, but it's also kind of an identifier or a USP to someone who go, well, rare, maybe I'll give that a go. And the use of rare apple ice wine has kind of broken down barriers to some extent, because if I was sending someone a cider, like say someone like Jancis Robinson, I'm not really sure it would get the same regard. But things are changing now, you know, like some of the stuff Susanna Forbes is doing is amazing. I mean, I think I read Little Pomona ciders up there, some of the best I've tasted, just because they're so challenging, they're so unique, and that's pushing the boundaries of perception. And there is hopefully a change coming where people perceive cider as something else. But I mean, Ireland per capita drinks more cider than anywhere else in the world, but in terms of craft cider, the appreciation would be nowhere near the level of appreciation that would exist in the UK, or no, sorry, not the UK, the US. In terms of identifying premium ciders, it's a very small market over here, you know. So that's kind of the reason for that.
Well, I don't know. I think we're all kind of in the same cider boat, but let's just talk about this particular ice wine, as you're calling it. For listeners who aren't familiar, what they have here is that you're using that same traditional method that was founded in Quebec. and that's where you are freezing the fresh pressed juice, and then separating the water from the juice essentially as it thaws out, and then you're fermenting it. Is that correct? Is that how you are making this particular product?
Largely speaking, I'm not sure if you have the chocolate or the candy, you might call it, Twix. Do you have a Twix over in America?
Yes, we do. Yep.
Well, you know, someone was asking me, so, well, how do they do it in Canada and how do you do it? And is it the same as it? Well, there's an ad they have over here of like Left Twix covers biscuit fingers in caramel and chocolate. Right Twix has a biscuit, then there's some chocolate and there's some caramel. You know, Left Twix and Right Twix are the same, but Canada is essentially uses natural freezing and artificial heat to thaw, and we use, you know, artificial cooling and natural heat to thaw. So mm-hmm. it's no less natural than the Canadian process. There's a little bit of bit of something going. I think, you know, you have to use natural cold. I'm not sure it makes a difference, but essentially that's what we do. We do it manually. Everything is slowly done. And what we do is then we ferment slowly. I use gradual racking. We don't have a cross flow filter. We don't use sulfites to the extent that we could stop it. And essentially it's kind of Claude Jolicoeur's kind of method. I did an experiment, and just to take a step back where it came from. I was making cider and I was giving people cider, and I could remember my own lack of ability to differentiate a good cider from a not so good cider. And it does take a little bit of palate education before you can spot the length of finish, the malolactic notes, the properly balanced Brettanomyces notes, the proper balance of acid, sugar, and length of finish and carbonation. But I did an experiment with some apple brandy that I'd made, and some kind of hedgerow poutine, you might call it. That I just mixed with some bittersweet juice, and I just said, you know what, I'm going to make 5 liters of that, and I'm going to stick it under the stairs. And he did that, and I came back, and I stuck some bits of oak in it, and I said, look, I heard about this thing called Pomo, and hadn't really studied it. And I gave it to someone 6 months later, and I tasted it myself, and I was like, this tastes kind of special. And I gave it to someone, they had a taste, and they went, whoa, what's that? Mm. And it just kind of became clear that you don't need to explain something like that to someone. They appreciate it straight off. Whereas I'm trying to explain to someone about cider, there's a length to finish to this, it's made in this way, we mature for a year. And that became kind of a light bulb moment. It's like, actually, you know, if you make something that is unique and does kind of, to some extent, punch you in the face with apples, then that's enough. And then I kind of wanted to extend that then to the I'd read about rare apple ice wine, I'd read about Canadian ice cider. Mm-hmm. Very small little article that I found somewhere, and this is probably maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And that just sounded amazing. So I kind of did some experiments with a couple of different apple varieties, and just in small scale. And it started to become kind of clear that this is probably something that we should do in a larger volume.
Yeah, well, I'd like to talk a little bit about what's in my glass here, because I think you do have something very unique here, primarily because you have these specific apple varieties that you're putting into what I would call an ice cider. I'm going to just begin so folks could have a little visual. The color of this is much deeper and more caramel, like caramelized apple color, like a deep brown amber. There's a heavy viscosity to it. And the nose just is not, you're not getting a lot of volatile, you know, alcohol fumes or anything like that. It's, again, that kind of almost like a roasted apple. But what was really unique for the palate, at least my palate, was the tannin structure there that you don't typically find in an iced cider, primarily because of those apple varieties. So the fact that you had the ability to use what most folks would covet for their cider and put it into an ice cider, because you need so much more actual apples to make this type of product. That makes it unique. It leaves this like feathery finish, mouthfeel, Very, very unique. You don't ever get that from a classic ice cider. So it stands out. Initially, you're like, wow, this is something different. And then you get that full mouth kickback there, and you're like, it's bringing you further into the experience. But I really want folks out in Ciderville to realize that what Kilahora Orchards, what you're doing there with this particular product is absolutely unique. At this point, I have not had an ice cider in this way. And it is, I think, it also speaks volumes of your rare apple cider, too, and probably subsequent products you're going to be making, is that you are playing with apples, and it all comes down to the apple, doesn't it? What you're putting in there changes the profile immensely. Even if I would be in Normandy, France, what you're keeving, if you keeved in your cider house there, I know straight out, even if you try to use this exact same technique, because of the terroir you have and the varieties and the soil structure that you obviously are very lucky to have, you're going to create a different product. And that is what somehow you've been able to capture that in the bottle in a really profound way. So bravo to that. I'm going to do a little double click to you. And again,
likewise.
There you go. It's just a beautiful drink. It's really rich. The presentation, it comes in a classic dessert wine bottle, a lovely logo on it with inked apple with what you'd call like a snowflake in the background. A lovely presentation. Then when you bring it into the palate, the presentation is just furthers you. It's something that everybody should be able to experience. I'm wondering, I know that this was the 2016. How is it looking for the future for folks to be able to get this particular product or any of your products outside of your area? What is the range of, and should we refer to it as Kilahora Orchards, or should we just say the range for Johnny Falldown? Because you have two different labels here, and I really want folks to realize what they're going for.
Yeah, it's a little confusing. It's a little confusing even for us, to be honest. But like, we started with Johnny Falldown. I suppose a bit of context is that there's an old Irish song called Johnny Jump Up, and it was actually the first kind of viral marketing song for a drink. It was post, I'm not sure, is it World War I or World War II, but it was around a time when there was a shortage of grain, so they were just making cider, and people weren't really drinking it because it had kind of fallen out of favor, you know, post-famine. It wasn't something that was around. And Johnny Falldown, it's a little cheekier. It's not necessarily in keeping with a premium product such as the apple port or the rare apple ice wine. So we've kind of taken a step back and called it Kilahora Orchards, which is the estate, which allows us then to do different products under that umbrella, and Johnny Falldown cider would be one of those products. So really, we're kind of, Kilahora Orchards would be the company, and would be the collective of us and what we're doing, really.
Yeah, that's good to know. One other thing I want to say about this rare apple ice wine in my glass is, folks should know that it's not coyingly like sweet. A lot of times folks will, you know, it depends, like different genders might go for that, but I find that this is, for my palate, exactly what I want. And
I'm glad you said that, actually. That was one of the things that I was debating, and it's something that has been a plus rather than a minus. So we took it up to the kind of around the standard that people will take it up above 35, 36 in Brix terms, and brought it down to less than half of it. I took it to a sommelier in a local restaurant, the Greens. It's one of the better ones in the country. And I took a kind of a sweeter one and a more bittersweet one. And I did it in a couple of different 200-liter tanks, because I didn't really want to just chuck them all in and not really know which is good and which isn't. And it was the drier ones, which he thought had more flexibility in pairing. And it's really in the pairing is the strength of this. Like, Ireland makes some of the best cheeses that I've tasted. I mean, you know, France aside, with some amazing milk and goats and so on. But we don't really have a unique after dinner drink to drink it with. Like, look, like, you know, Guinness isn't made from Irish barley, and it isn't something you're drinking after. There's a lot of great whiskies, some of which aren't made from Irish barley. I mean, that wasn't central to what we were doing, but they're not necessarily great with cheese. Whereas this and our port are, and I wanted to make sure it paired well. So I had some people taste it, and they all said the same thing. Don't make it too sweet. Makes it harder to pair. Like, we've paired this with foie gras. We've paired it with, it just works excellent with goat cheese. And that slight dryness has given it that advantage, and it's made it more accessible. I was speaking to a master of wine recently, and she commented on the dryness. And this year, to answer the question, is the 2017, thankfully, has turned that same corner after its maturation period, where it goes from being possibly slightly too alcoholic or possibly slightly misshapen in a way. And I kind of think of flavor, like, flavor was my first love. Getting into this is a conduit for releasing that passion for flavor. And balance is where I think my strength is in trying to find that balance. And in creating this particular drink, or this style of drink, it was seeking that balance, which gives you a freshness of acidity at the start, it gives you acidity that starts just before the sweetness, but the sweetness doesn't overtake the acidity. The acidity is almost like a single note that goes through it. The sugar comes up, the sugar waves away, the acidity keeps going, and then the tannins come along. And by the time the tannins come along, the acidity is just starting to wave goodbye, and your tannins have that length. So it was trying to create that journey of taste was the goal with this. Unfortunately, 2017 is similar. Now, the year that we've had has been warmer. We've had a freakishly warm summer, which to the rest of the world would be what you call a normal summer. But in Ireland, we don't get them too often. In fact, when I was born in 1976 was the last year that we had this degree of actual proper sunshine. So consequently, the ABV will probably be about 11.5, 11.8. I just couldn't, like, even with racking, it just kept going. I was kind of starting to hit the panic button. So I kind of had to rack and filter and rack and filter. But so it's drier. It's about maybe 5 to 8% drier. And I was slightly concerned about, like, will I have to kind of put in fresh juice to it? And I'd be slightly concerned that might restart it. But no, it's good. It's slightly drier. It's maintaining that slightly drier edge. I mean, it's still largely within the parameters of a kind of a recommended sweetness for a nice wine. But
this isn't just a dessert drink. This is you know, if I was a cigar smoker, I'd probably have it in a cigar lounge. You know, it really lets you sit back, and it doesn't, like, go to the top of your head. It is a mouth experience. Really appreciate you taking the time to both send these quality ciders my way and to speak with us here on Cider Chat today.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. You know, I mean, I've been listening to Cider Chat since I really kind of started to grow, and wanting to grow and wanting to learn more. I've learned a lot from it. And, you know, if Ciderville ever is going to elect a mayor, I think it should be you.
That's really kind of you.
Yeah, that was a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And it's you know, Apple geekery isn't something that I necessarily get the opportunity to chat for at length before someone either leaves or closes the door. It's a great opportunity. And I mean, I've, you know, some of the brightest and best of the cider world have been on this show, and I'm happy to be on the same hallowed airwaves.
Wonderful. That was Barry Walsh of Killahora Orchards, based in County Cork, Ireland. If you wait to the very end of this here podcast, you're going to hear Barry singing the Irish drinking song, Johnny Jump Up. He'll be singing a wee bit of it, because I guess it's a pretty long song, as, you know, drinking songs can go. And it's fantastic, so do stay tuned for that. And as far as getting these products that we were talking about, well, you might have to wait a little bit as they kind of keep on scaling it up and having the apple trees grow, which is kind of what happens all around in Ciderville right now. So stay tuned to this channel, and as that news comes my way, you know I will be sharing it with you. For the folks who are patrons of this here podcast, well, again, remember, I will be posting online via the Cider Chat Patreon page about a 15-minute clip, not only talking about the perry that they're making at Killahora Orchard, but also the pommeau, which is what they call an apple port, what the French might call a pommeau, and how they are using, of course, whiskey barrels to age cider. So that's a nice piece there. Make sure that you get to listen to it. And don't forget, you could become a patron too and get all those little extras, including knowing that you're helping support cider going up around the world. Just go to the Cider Chat page at Patreon. I have to start packing my bags because next week I will be in Monterey Bay, California, bringing my mama back to my brother for the winter. So you know I'm looking forward to seeing some of my good friends and cider makers in that region. So stay tuned for that. I have some interesting stories coming up in that area. In the meanwhile, this is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Let me tell you a story that happened to me. One day as I went down to Yall by the sea, the sun it was hot and the day it was warm. I figured a quiet pint would do me no harm. I went in and I asked for a bottle of stout, and the barman said, "Sorry, but the beer is sold out. Try whiskey or paddy, 10 years in the wood." I said I'd try cider, I heard it was good. No, never, no, never, no, never again, if I live to be 100 or 110. I fell to the ground and I could not get up, after drinking a quart of that Johnny Jump Up. After downing a quart, I went out to the yard, where I bumped into Brophy, the big civic guard. He said to me, "Come here, boy, don't you know I'm the law?" So I up with me fist and I shattered his jaw. He fell to the ground and he couldn't get up. Sure, 'twasn't I hit him, 'twas Johnny Jump Up. The next thing I remember in Yall by the sea was a cripple on crutches, and says he to me, "I'm afraid of me life, I'll be hit by a car. Won't you help me across to the railwayman's bar?" After downing a quart of that cider so sweet, he threw down his crutches and danced on his feet. Oh, never, oh, never, oh, never again, if I live to be 100 or 110. I fell to the ground and I could not get up, after drinking a quart of that Johnny Jump Up.
Yeehaw!